Hi everyone, welcome to Journeys with PDA Coffee Chat podcast, where we seek connection, community, and co-regulation while discussing all things PDA. Hello, and welcome to Journeys with PDA Coffee Chat podcast. I'm Heather.
And I'm Carissa. Today we have a really special guest with us, Dr. Gina Forman, who is a clinical pharmacist and very familiar with PDA.
And while today we'll be talking about medications, we want to clarify that we're not giving out any kind of medical advice or any type of prescribing of medications. This podcast chat is just for informational purposes only, and it's important that you contact your own medical provider.
So thank you, Gina, for being here with us today. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Dr. Gina Forman. Thank you so much, Heather and Carissa, for inviting me on today. I'm so excited to be here. I am a clinical pharmacist. I graduated pharmacy school in 2013, and I have residency training and board certifications previously in general pharmacotherapy and now in infectious diseases. So I've been practicing as a pharmacist for over 10 years now, and I am here on Journeys with PDA because my history is that I have a daughter who was diagnosed autistic 3 years ago, and I, as a medical professional, I fell very much into the camp of looking at autism as a medical disability because that was what I was taught. Going through all of my training and all of my prior experience, not being close to anyone who I knew was diagnosed as autistic at the time. And so since then, I have been learning as much as I can about autism. Whenever we got our diagnosis for my daughter, there was this period of time where I wanted to do all the things. I followed very firmly in the advice that we were given by the diagnostician, and followed all of the therapies and recommendations that I was given, very much following in the medical model and trying to be a very compliant medical professional. And in doing so, it became clear pretty quickly that this was not what was best for my daughter, and that there was something else going on. And that led us to get an additional diagnosis of ADHD about a year later. And we did attempt medication at that time. And I was hoping, you know, that the medication would be helpful. And at that time she was in services, you know, previously she was in over 40 hours a week of services. I noticed that things were not going well. We cut down to 20 hours a week of services, got the ADHD diagnosis, started medication, doing all the things, right, to try to respond to the difficulty that my daughter was having. And it just, everything escalated from there on out. She began experiencing medication avoidance and school avoidance. And ultimately, I made the decision to pull her out of school at about the time that I discovered pathological demand avoidance. And realizing that my daughter fit the PDA profile of autism was the light bulb moment that I had been hoping to find to finally understand how my daughter's brain worked. And so around that time, I found Christy Forbes and all of her work. She was the one who I found on Instagram, and that's how I found out about PDA and what it was. And since then, I've you know, got a lot of good resources in people like Amanda Diekman and Laura Kirby and Eliza Fricker, and of course you, Heather and Carissa and Dusty at Journeys with PDA. I'm so grateful that I found this beautiful community of people to finally have a sense of belonging and community and support that I had been searching for and that my daughter had been searching for. So thank you.
We're so happy that you found us.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. And it's really exciting as we get to know the people in our community and the exciting expertise that they can bring in you know, and just build up the community, and we can learn and grow together. And so we're so excited to have you here with us as one of our community members. And so we're super thankful for you. And you have a lot of really incredible knowledge, and I feel like we have a lot of questions. So let's get started and talk about medications. Because I think that there's a lot of, it's a tricky area for parents, because as just an individual, I don't have a lot of really great information, or I can't necessarily understand. So having the opportunity to talk to someone who actually knows what all this means is amazing. And my opinion is that medication can be a really great tool to help support our kids. And that's my opinion. And I've seen that help my kids. And so there's going to be people who have different opinions, and maybe they don't want to medicate their kids. And we completely respect that. But I think that sometimes there's a lot of misunderstanding, and that if we had a better and deeper understanding of like how medications work, and how does dosing work, and what are, you know, like what are the different types of medications available?
Why am I giving a stimulant to someone who is already hyperactive?
Right?
Right.
Which was so like mind blowing for me. And I was like, no, you don't understand. Like, it's like she's bouncing off the walls. And so I think that like if we had a better understanding of how meds worked, then we could use that tool so much better. And I think that sometimes parents are afraid to kind of ask silly questions to the doctors. And but I didn't go to med school. I don't know any of this stuff. So let's get in. So what's like that basic like first kind of step we need to know when we're talking about medications?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to do a quick disclaimer that anything that I say today is not intended as individual medical advice. It is not within my scope of practice to diagnose any medical problem. So I won't be discussing diagnostics or the diagnosis of any of these conditions or medical conditions that we talk about today. Additionally, I would recommend that you consult your own individual healthcare providers for medical advice if you have questions about any of this, because they will know your history. We do not. And additionally, I do want to say that there are no FDA approved. This is based in the United States, as far as I'm discussing here within my scope. There are no FDA approved treatments for autism or pathological demand avoidance. Okay, so I'm going to say all of that before I get started. So
yes, thank you.
There are some things that I cannot talk about, but I will do my best to give you all a very general working knowledge, like a pharmacy 101 here, so that you can have a better understanding of how medications work and why certain ones will be better choices than others for the individuals listening. So anyway, just to kind of get started, I think one thing that I want to talk about is the different dosage forms of medications. Just to kind of give you a broader understanding of the different dosage forms. Most of the medications that we're all familiar with are the ones that you take by mouth, right? Oral medications. So there's immediate release tablets, sustained release tablets, extended release tablets, and capsules. Not all dosage forms are created equal. And even though the milligrams on one formulation of methylphenidate are the same as another, the effective dose might be different. And especially when we talk about sustained or extended release products, the time at which those medications are released into your body, into your bloodstream, those are different over time. Like there might be peaks to that drug at different times in day. And I mean, that's a fairly common strategy for the treatment of ADHD with stimulants, as you brought up before. There are also non-oral options, but those are a lot fewer. And I can only speak about FDA-approved products. I can't really speak to any that might be compounded in private compounding pharmacies. And additionally, I don't do any compounding in my practice, so I'm really not up to date on those practices. So I'll only be talking about FDA-approved products, and I'll be using generic names as well. So there are patches for certain medications, like transdermal patches, you know, that you put on your skin. We do have a lot of injectable medications. In a hospital setting, we use a lot of injection and intravenous medications, though in the outpatient setting, like if you were going to be prescribed a medication, most of your medications are probably going to be given by the oral route, right? So just in general, that's something to consider. Now within the autistic community, there's a lot to consider in terms of sensory processing differences and what those needs might be. So if we're looking in the context of autistics, PDAers, those with sensory processing disorder, these things would all apply. So what I'm thinking in terms of the types of medications, sometimes we have to be creative, right, about how we can get our kids, especially young kids, to take medications. And so normally pediatricians will prescribe something like an oral solution or an oral suspension, something that's a liquid formulation for really small children, to allow them to take it more easily, because asking them to swallow a pill is generally not something that most young children can do. And again, that's just based on an individual level. But I think there's a couple things to consider here. One is whenever you talk to your healthcare provider about a medication that you may be starting yourself or your child might be starting, is to talk about the sensory issues of these different dosage forms. Like, for example, if you know your child cannot take a tablet, but that's the only way that this medication is available, it's likely going to cause problems for you to give that to your child. Now, some medications, tablets in particular, can be crushed and put in water or other liquids to be given. Now, I will say, if you use a strategy like this, that those medications may not be stable for long periods of time, meaning the drug will degrade in that food product potentially if it's in there for a long time. So like if your child struggles to take a medication and you're like, oh, well, I'll just sit it to the side. And then you come back 4 or 5 hours later and that drug is still sitting there on the applesauce or pudding or ice cream or whatever you've tried to use to get your child to get in the mood to take their medication, it's probably not going to be, and I say stable, but really effectiveness is what we're concerned about. You know, and as you may or may not be aware, some medications are stable at room temperature. Some need to be stored under refrigeration. It can only be at room temperature for certain periods of time. These are all things that you would want to look at the labeling on your prescription, or if you have questions about it, ask your pharmacist.
So this is some really interesting points, because I had no idea that if you put something in the applesauce, that like it kind of has a time limit. And so I want to kind of make sure, like, wow, I think that's something that a lot of us don't know. I had no idea. And so if that's your strategy, it's probably pretty important to make sure that like you're doing it right away. So I think that's a good thing to know. Another question, are there medications, is it a thing that there's some medications that should not be crushed up? Is that something that you need to check on before you go into crushing things up?
Yes. And this is particularly important for sustained release or extended release products. There's also such a thing as enteric coating, which is less common with a lot of medications, but like aspirin, for example, if you were having a heart attack, you would only want to have chewable or immediate release aspirin rather than enteric coated, because that enteric coating is meant for it to not start breaking down until it hits your stomach. But you want that in your system as soon as possible, right? So that's just one example of this issue. But in general, like I will give a specific example. So I mentioned that my daughter was diagnosed with ADHD, and at one point in time, she was taking Medidate CD, which is a specific product that is a sustained release capsule. And when you open the capsule, you can put it in food, but you can't crush the beads that are in the capsule. So that's how that sustained release product works, is the medication is coated around and inside these beads. And so what I would have to do is somehow either suspend those little beads in a liquid or a syrup, or put it on food that I knew that she would not chew, to try to give that to her. And so these are all things that you have to think about to try to make these medications more, you know, easy.
Palatable.
But also not destroy the medication.
Right. So it's interesting. That's why sometimes we pick up our medication and there's that little sticker on it that says, do not crush or chew, swallow whole.
Yeah. And a lot of times the effects, generally, this is a general statement, if you were to chew up a sustained release or extended release tablet or capsule, you would get more drug on the front end. The absorption would be quicker. The onset of action would be quicker, and you would have more effects at the front end of that medication's duration of action rather than the back end. Like if you're trying to take it for the purpose of it being extended release and lasting 12 hours, let's say, it's not going to last 12 hours if the mechanism for it to do that is disrupted.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So this is also why it's so important to discuss this type of a thing, one, with your medical provider, when you're, you know, exploring medications, but also talk to the pharmacist when you pick up your medications, because that would be devastating to be trying to help your child and giving them meds and then to not knowingly actually be decreasing the effectiveness.
And another, you know, this is just mom tips 101 here. I'm thinking back when we were trying all different kinds of medications for our son. Don't be afraid to contact your child's provider if a medication is not, if you can't, if the child is unable to take it in the route that it was prescribed. Because there are, you know, for some medications, there are different ways of, you know, redoing it or something like that. So just, you know, don't be afraid to contact the doctor again.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. It's, if you are familiar with the kinds of medications that, like, if you're going to an appointment for a specific reason and a medication may or may not be involved, I would try to plan ahead a little bit. At least this is what I do, you know, like thinking ahead, okay, I know the different products that are available. What specific one would be able, would my daughter be most able to access? And then I ask for that specific product. And again, there are so many things that go into it. Like we haven't even mentioned the fact that an America, we have healthcare insurance, which dictates a lot of the things that our healthcare providers are able to do for us and make them cost effective. And so there's just a lot of things to consider with that. I do also want to mention, like, advocating for your child in particular, you know, like, don't be afraid to advocate for a specific thing. If you need a specific thing, have that conversation with your healthcare provider and or your pharmacist, whichever one is applicable. It's obviously easier to make sure you get the prescription for the correct product with your healthcare provider when you're there. But if you know there are sensory, especially oral sensory issues, or if you're going to be prescribed a patch or a cream or something, having that frank conversation with healthcare providers is almost better to do on the front end. If you're afraid that, you know, your child may struggle with a specific intervention, it's better to have those conversations on the front end. And that's been my personal experience as well. One other thing I was going to mention, which is specific to PDA, my daughter experienced medication avoidance, whenever she was, nearing burnout or a crisis point. And I just want to say that sometimes it's very hard to elucidate what the cause of medication avoidance is. In the medical world, we call it, non-adherence or compliance. And I don't think that those terms are fair because they are not nuanced enough to really look into the reasons why people may have difficulty taking their medications routinely. And so if we talk about PDA specifically, I think the sensory piece is huge and should always be considered. I also think that medication avoidance is something else to consider. And having conversations, you know, sometimes maybe that looks like problem solving with older kids. If it is a sensory issue and that's why you have medication avoidance, well, then that's something that you can work on and you can advocate together to try to get something that's going to work, right? Maybe it's a side effect issue. Maybe they don't feel good when they take the medication and that's why they don't want to take it. Or maybe their nervous system is just so escalated that they can't access medication at that time. And so I think that getting to the bottom of that medication avoidance is super important to think about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we understand that it can be a little tough out there. We understand that sometimes it's difficult to, you know, we ask a question to our PDAers and of course a question is a demand. And, you know, they'd rather set their fingers on fire than answer a question for us. But you know that we completely understand that there can be difficulty around that as well.
Yeah.
But it's also important to, I think, acknowledge that like what you're saying is that these children will have legitimate reason can't take the medication. And I think that especially when we're talking about a PDA or an autistic person is, there is a reason for that. And, it's really important. Whether you're collaborating and problem solving or, however you do it, it's really important that if that child is having difficulty with their medication, that, you honor that and really look into like, why is this so hard for you? We have always involved my daughter in med appointments. and she's always included in making the decisions for her meds. I think that's really important for a PDA or they need to be heard and being involved in that process, I think is really really important. And there's an age where, you know, they might be too young, but, just honoring that when they can't do it.
Something else from kind of an overall perspective that I want to comment on, with specifically with regards to regulation. So you may be familiar with the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA being the regulatory body for prescription drugs in the United States. But what most people don't realize is that over-the-counter medications and supplements are regulated by the Federal Trade Commission, and they do not have to undergo any efficacy studies, effectiveness studies, prior to those products being sold. And they don't undergo the same rigor in their testing as FDA-approved medications do. So I just want to put that out there because I know there's a lot of people in the community and in general,
yeah,
like, that use over-the-counter medications and supplements. Like, this is a common problem. But I will say, like, I listened to the podcast that you did with Suzanne Gunn, and she mentioned melatonin. Well, that's one that's commonly used, right? Like, as a sleep medication, melatonin is very commonly used. From a regulatory perspective, it's not an FDA, like all of these melatonin over-the-counter products, none of them are FDA approved. And there was a study done a few years ago that actually showed that the potency of the milligram content that it showed in the melatonin products, you know, tablet, capsule, gummy, whatever it was that they tested 30 different products, and found that there could either be 83% less of that dose or 478% more of that dose that was on the labeling on that bottle. And so that specific example just shows the variation in over-the-counter supplements. Mm-hmm. And so I say that as a person who uses over-the-counter medications and vitamins, but also as a word of caution, because these things can be very variable.
Sure.
The effects can be variable. So that's one other just little disclaimer info.
Sure. And then, you know, just for a little disclaimer for Suzanne's sake, she's not an advocate at all of melatonin. Yeah. I just want to throw that out there. Just, we did have the melatonin conversation. And honestly, since then, we've backed my son up 50% of his melatonin, and he's been doing okay. So he's just, he has this like psychological attachment to it that he doesn't want to get a bit up because he's afraid that then he won't be able to sleep. And then he goes into this cycle of, hey, I'm not going to be able to sleep. So anyways, so sleep was before. Here we go. We'll put a bookmark in that. We'll put a pin in that and keep talking about just meds. Sorry about that.
But that's
chasing the rabbit.
Well, that's also like it. That's such a good example of why, when you are meeting with your medical providers, you need to also discuss with them what over the counter products you're using.
Yes.
Even if it is something like Advil, Tylenol, melatonin, you still need to be talking with your medical provider about those things too, because, we're just kind of guessing as parents. And so it's important to get that professional support, even with those types of meds.
Yeah, you're right, Carissa. And from a safety perspective, it's really important to be transparent with your healthcare providers about any medication substance that you're taking, whether it's a supplement, whether it's a prescription drug, whether you smoke on the weekends. Like, be transparent with your healthcare providers, you know, because they, in order to make good decisions for people, we need to have all of that information available. Especially from my perspective, to assess for drug interactions. That's a huge focus of what we do from a safety perspective. And without knowing that information, we can't, provide good recommendations for our patients either, if we don't know. So.
Sure. So, on the same track as safety, what are some of the basic kind of things that go around medication and safety and maybe their effectiveness? And, you know, like, why can't I take 4 Tylenol if I have a really bad headache? because it really hurts. And if, you know, if two work really well, shouldn't four work? I'm being very sarcastic for people who cannot see me on the video. That was Heather being sarcastic. Don't take four Tylenol.
But that's such a great point. Because my daughter, who's now a teenager, has gotten to the point where she says, I have a headache. Can I have some ibuprofen? And, you know, we help her have that. But she has asked me that, like, why can't I take four? And I was like, you know, like dosage of anything is really important. So kind of help, talk about effectiveness, why four isn't needed and two is enough, and the safety around all of that.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to give you a general framework for evaluating this. Dosages, just a brief thing on dosages, is you can look at one medication and another one, and they're in different milligram quantities, and you look at those and you're like, oh, well, if I take two of those, it equals one of that other drug. It doesn't work that way. Every drug is individual, right? Its effects, its potency, its dosage, what the safety limits are on it. Every single drug is individual. And as a general rule, I would never recommend to take something more than what is prescribed by your healthcare provider or approved by your pharmacist. If you have questions, always ask. It's always better to ask than to do something that might be potentially unsafe, right? So, and in terms of medications in general, I kind of think of them as a risk versus benefit framework. And most medical interventions, this is kind of the framework in which we work from, looking at the effectiveness of a certain drug versus the safety profile of a certain drug. And depending on what you're using it for and the individual that's taking it, you have to work through a benefit versus risk framework for every decision that you make. And I would encourage, you know, and again, you have to have as much information as possible to make good decisions, right? And or informed decisions, whether they're good or not, I suppose, is that's a moral judgment that I can't make. But to have all the information gives you an informed decision of the benefits versus the risks of any intervention that you might take, right? And so for medications or drugs, like any substance is a drug. So I'm just going to say drug. So for any drug that you might take, there's something called a therapeutic window or therapeutic index. And so that would be what we would call the effectiveness, right? So anything down here would be ineffective. This would be your effectiveness range. And then the top of the effectiveness range is usually the safety range, right? You can go up to a certain point. Anything more than that may be toxic, right? So that's kind of the general framework that we work in and evaluating things from a benefit versus risk standpoint. Now, you know, there are a lot of things in life that are fairly low risk, that are not drugs. There are some drugs that are pretty low risk to take as well. But some things that are very low risk, if we're looking at our population, would be things like lowering demands for your PDA-er. There's almost no risk there, right? Probably none to minimal risk to doing that, and potentially a lot of benefit. I have started unschooling my daughter. She's been away from school at home for a year now, and that is a no risk intervention. She's home. She's in her home, in her safe place. And there's no risk to her there, but a lot of benefit potentially, right? Which we have seen benefits. So I can speak to my personal experience, but I'm just giving an example of these things that are potentially highly effective interventions that are not risky, right? When you look at drugs, there's almost always a potential risk. Now, whether that risk is high or low, again, it kind of depends on that therapeutic window that you're looking at, right? If it's a really narrow window and you don't have a lot of margin for error, those are medications that could have potentially severe or a lot of side effects. We have a wider therapeutic window that we're looking at. Those medications are generally a lot safer. And so that's one just kind of visually something that you can tuck away in your mind and thinking, like, why is it not okay to take 4 Tylenol instead of 2? It's because the therapeutic window on that medication is a little bit narrower than we'd like, right? So hopefully that all kind of makes sense. We refer to, you know, things like supports that you put in place for your child, like the supports that we talk about for PDA. Those are non-pharmacological supports, meaning they're non-medication supports, right? And again, there are no approved medications for PDA. But as I know that you're aware, and a lot of people in our community are aware, in the autistic community, there are a ton of co-occurring conditions. And so for a lot of these different co-occurring conditions, medications are first-line therapy. And so I think it's still important to have that framework.
So
I can keep talking. I can keep talking about safety unless you have a question.
So I have this kind of ties in with safety, but so talking about kind of like how do you metabolize a medication and how can that be different for different people? So I think that does kind of tie in with safety and with dosage and, you know, clear communication. Why do some meds seem to work or, you know, some seem to not work as great? For example, ibuprofen will like really take care of my husband's headache. It helps him a ton. I feel like I take and it does nothing. I like to take a leave, you know? So like how does that, you know, how do different bodies work with different medications?
That's a very complex question, Carissa. I'm going to do my best to answer it.
9 out just of 10 pharmacists recommend.
just give us more of like the basics of, you know, metabolizing or how, you know, how absorption and distribution, you know, how did that work in your body?
Yeah. So I think a couple of things I want to say generally is I mentioned that there's a lot of co-occurring conditions in the autistic community. One resource for reading about some of those would be All Brains Belong Vermont. Dr. Mel Hauser has something called All the Things, and it's a lot of the co-occurring conditions that are seen in the autistic community. And so that's a good resource if you want to dive a little bit deeper on that. In terms of safety, a term that we use in pharmacy is pharmacokinetics, which is what your body does to a drug whenever you take it. And we break down pharmacokinetics into 4 different stages: absorption, distribution, metabolism, and elimination or excretion. So there are, again, as I said, a lot of co-occurring conditions in the autistic community. Some that may affect absorption of medications. Gastrointestinal issues are very common in the autistic community. And in particular, there's a couple that might have implications on the absorption of drugs. Most of the time, drugs are absorbed in the stomach or the beginning of the small intestine, particularly the duodenum. If someone has a condition like gastroparesis, where the transit of food through your GI tract is slowed, then absorption will be slowed. There's also some issues with medications that you might take, like if you take any kind of antacid medications, that will change the pH of your stomach, and that can affect the absorption of certain medications. I'll give an example. So like if you take iron, if you have iron deficiency anemia or an iron deficiency, or you just take iron as a supplement, no matter how you, for what reason you take it, it preferentially requires an acidic environment to be absorbed. And in fact, we commonly give it with vitamin C because vitamin C or ascorbic acid is an acid. You could take it with apple or orange juice also, but that would increase the absorption of iron because you would have that acidic environment. And so that's one thing to consider. Others have had surgeries, for example, things like gastric bypass surgery, or if you've had any kind of surgery on the small intestine, part of that removed, that would also significantly affect the absorption of medications, and or slow it down, or like both of those things potentially. So those are some things from an absorption perspective. There's also the issue of some medications you should take with food and some you should not take with food. And again, that should be on the labeling of any prescription that you would fill. And sometimes taking it with food can decrease side effects. Like with certain antibiotics, I recommend to take them with food. But then again, there's some that could bind to food that you take and they would be less effective. So again, you just have to pay attention to the specific labeling on the products that you're getting. So that's absorption issues broadly, generally. Distribution refers to where drugs go whenever they're absorbed into your bloodstream. Some of them prefer to stay in your bloodstream, and some of them will deposit in certain tissues in the body, like fat tissue, for example. Sometimes drugs that like to hang out in your fat tissue, like estrogen, for example, they can prolong the effects of those medications. And other medications, like again, if you're taking an antibiotic and you have a bone infection, you want to make sure that it gets to that. Another significant consideration is your brain. Your brain has something called the blood-brain barrier around it, which is a lipophilic barrier, and it's to keep your brain safe, to keep your nervous system safe. You know, that's its normal function, but it also prevents some medications from getting there. So things like anti-seizure medications, you know, you have to consider, okay, is this medication going to reach the blood-brain barrier? Is this antibiotic going to get to someone's brain if they have meningitis? Those kind of things. So those are just kind of broadly distribution issues, and there's not a lot you can do about that. One thing that's variable based on disease states more so is some drugs have protein binding. You have a lot of proteins that are free flowing in your bloodstream, and some medications will bind to proteins. Now, if you are malnourished, you know, like, or if you're underweight, or if you have difficulty accessing food, sometimes people's albumin can be low, and albumin is one of those proteins that are in your bloodstream that bind medications. And so that can cause some variability in medications and the way that they work. Now, again, it's going to vary medication to medication, and these are all things that, you know, your healthcare provider or pharmacist would be considering if we had access to labs and industry and all that kind of stuff.
Which labs are so important.
I was just going to say that's why, you know, lab work is important. And, you know, so, but that gives us some really great insight on why the labs are important and why the doctor needs that information. Because if you have an autistic child, a blood draw is like, that could be really scary or rough or, you know, and so you're going to be like, please let's not. But that can be critically important information.
It goes back to that risk benefit, you know, having to weigh that. Yeah. But now I know why they looked at my albumin levels, you know, like why albumin? Like, all I could think of was like a chicken egg, you know, because the stuff in the chicken, I'm like, I've got chicken egg stuff floating around, but now it makes sense. Okay. Yeah. Speaking of duration of medication wearing off, okay, this is a really late recording that we're doing for Heather. So it just gets more fun from here. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Again, there I go. Down that bunny trot.
But there's so much interesting information. This is all completely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I'm so surprised somehow that there's so much of this that I just, like, I didn't know. I had no idea. And so, I didn't know that iron needed, you know, more acidic environment to be absorbed.
Write that down. I have notes because I'm taking my iron with my Prilosec. So I'm thinking that's probably not a good combination. I even wrote myself a note to change it up.
Yeah.
And those of you who are not watching the YouTube video of this, Gina's just sitting back kind of shaking her head. No.
I'm not here to give individual advice, but if you're going to offer yourself up, Heather,
that's fine. And then they're doing blood work and they're like, you're slightly anemic. I'm like, how can I take the best iron. I take, you know, if I take double, you know, it's like, I don't want to be constipated because, you know, so there's all these different. Yeah. So now I know Heather, I'm writing a note. Heather takes iron at a different time. Okay. Settled. Thank you.
So this is why it's so important to talk with someone about all the medications, like your whole list of medications, but also
everybody asks. I go to the doctor. I'm sorry. I go to the doctor. I take yes. Because by now I'm 50 and it's a laundry list. Nobody has ever told me to separate my iron from my Prilosec. It's okay.
So
I'm sorry.
I was not talking
to the right people. I'm sorry.
Now you're talking to the right people.
I am.
But it's such valuable information. And like this whole time, I'm just like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And like, I don't even know what kind of med it is, but I know that I have seen some sort of medication that says like don't take with grapefruit, and I'm like in my mind I cannot even in the slightest bit fathom like why that would be, but now we're like digging into this and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's important. Not that I eat grapefruits or take that kind of medication. I don't even know what that is, but
so I can answer this question next because we're going to talk about metabolism because you mentioned that, Carissa. So grapefruit and grapefruit juice, there's a compound in there that is metabolized via an enzyme pathway that interacts with a lot of medications. So the enzymatic pathway or family of enzymes that's most commonly implicated in drug interactions is called the cytochrome P450 system, or CYP450 is usually how we abbreviate it. But there's quite a few different enzymes within that family. They're located in all tissues of your body, these enzymes, but they're primarily located in your intestines and liver, which is where the majority of drug metabolism happens. If you're taking a medication that is metabolized via the CYP3A4 enzyme, grapefruit is off the table.
The more you know.
It should say that again on the labeling. Mm-hmm. For any medication that is a 3A4 medication. So metabolism is really complex, and there are some medications. So there's basically like three different ways that medications interact with these enzymes, or rather the enzymes interact with the medication in some cases. So it can either induce an enzyme, meaning make more of that enzyme. It can be a substrate for it, like the enzyme breaks it down, or it can inhibit the enzyme's abilities. It's almost, when I explain it like that, it almost sounded like you were playing a video game and the drug showed up in the liver and the enzymes are like, ooh, what's going to happen?
I pictured like different colored enzymes, like doing different things to them. Like, ooh, this one, ooh, this one likes this one.
Yeah.
Ooh, this one likes it.
So this gets really complicated because again, the CYP450 system, it's a family of enzymes. And so there's a lot of potential enzymes that could be implicated. Sometimes drugs inhibit or interact with multiple enzymes. And so there could be multiple issues with metabolism. Some just interact with one. We're super lucky and spoiled now in the modern age that all of our software programs that we're using, they flag us for things like this now. Prior to the technology age, you had to memorize all of these things flat out, right? And like some things, you know, that you see all the time, they stick in your brain, right? But
picturing everybody with like a little slide rule coming up.
pull out my pocket protector with all of the list of the enzymes on it and let you know if that's okay or not.
The pharmacist death success reference.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I'm just going to say, it freaks me a little bit. It doesn't happen so much anymore, but like when you go to the doctor and they just pull that physician's desk reference out. I mean, half of me is happy that they're looking at it. And the other half is going, I'm not sure. Right. It's like, maybe would it be better to like leave and look it up and then come back or, you know, anyway. So yeah. All right. Sorry.
You're right, though, because I mean, our compendia used to be in those huge books,
mm-hmm.
like all of our drug information. We had to look in those massive books. Like, thank God
I can't even
for
imagine.
Technology. Thank God for the internet, because it makes our job so much easier, so much easier. And like to have the amount of information that we have at our fingertips is incredible.
Right?
Truly. It's incredible. Like the things that we are able to do for people in a short and efficient time frame, it's amazing.
It's a great really. Time to be alive.
It is.
Right?
And our goal is to keep it that way, right?
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's kind of incredible. One thing that I really want to point out with drug metabolism is that these enzymes can vary a lot in terms of your genetic profile, how much of each enzyme you produce in your body. Every brain is different. Every body is different. Right? And your genetic makeup, genetic testing is becoming more routine in the medical setting to look for these enzymatic differences in terms of drug metabolism, in terms of, you know, hereditary diseases, and you know, the constellation of, you know, all the things or all of these other diseases that we have in place now. And it's kind of amazing because some of these pharmacogenomic tests that you can do now, it can spit out your entire profile. Well, you're a poor metabolizer of this enzyme and you're an ultra metabolizer of this enzyme. And so these are the kind of medications that you can or should not take, potentially, that may not be safe for you to take. And if you are able to access those kind of tests, do it.
It's brilliant. They're brilliant.
If you're able to access a yes. provider that will do it for you. Like, it's incredible information.
Yep.
And yep. it only makes you safer.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that the information makes you safer, especially in terms of medications. If you know that you're deficient in a specific enzyme, you can avoid those medications altogether.
Right. You know? And they even give you, like, when you get the report, they give you this little card that you can keep in your wallet and give to your provider.
Or you can keep it all on your phone.
Or you can keep online. On the
Hello.
Phone. Hello.
You can have a report
right?
saved on your phone yeah. and be like, okay,
yep.
here, doc, here's your reference.
Yep.
These are all the things
that
I gave
away.
You.
You just put that physician's down.
Like, I have the internet.
That's
with
right.
my results right here.
That is fantastic.
But
that
it is. It's amazing information.
It really is. It absolutely is. And it's, again, it's a great time to be alive. I mean, great time. I'm just fascinated with all of the things. So
You know, we are probably going to have to do a part two with you.
I think so. I think we're going to need
a part two. We didn't hit all the things I think we need to hit on this. But we are so excited that you joined us today and you shared with us your expertise on all things medicine. And thank you so much.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you for, man, such a wealth of of knowledge and, you know, helping us advocate for ourselves or for our kids better. So we appreciate you, and we would love for you to come back and do a part two with us.
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, perfect. If you would like more information about pathological demand avoidance, you can find us on the World Wide Web at journeyswithpda.com. You can email us at journeyswithpda@gmail.com.